This is Gem Archer, and you're listening to the Stage Left podcast. In fucking one.
Didn't ask you to write it down or anything.
Welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of the unsung heroes behind the success. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. Go to thestageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring musicians who discuss in detail the recording, writing and performing processes with the likes of Elvis Presley, David Bowie, Michael Jackson, Beyonce, The Beatles, Gorillaz, Radiohead, Fleetwood Mac, Nick Cave, Guns N' Roses, Alanis Morissette, Bob Dylan, Jeff Lynne and Kraftwerk. Today we are joined by cellist Liz Hanks, most notable for performing with a plethora of incredible artists such as Liam Gallagher, Self Esteem, Richard Hawley, James, and even Smokey Robinson, who has just released a new album, original material for the new album Land, which is released on Hudson Records on the 2nd of June, and is also about to join Pulp on their new comeback tour. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is none other than Liz Hanks. Thanks for joining us today, Liz. How's it going?
Really good, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Now, I'd like to pick up on something that we talked about in the last previous couple of episodes, actually. Firstly, with Bim from Bastille and then Kate Nash, about this idea that Bim said that the music industry hasn't been built for women, and that things like tour buses were probably not designed with women in mind, and touring can be quite difficult as a woman because there hasn't been inclusive design, i.e. the size of the height of toilet seats and some of the things that women might need on a tour bus aren't there. And even that kind of can be expanded to preparation time and that kind of thing. From your experience in the music industry, what have you seen that's changed that's made things perhaps more inclusive that always should have been there, and what needs to change still?
So what would I change? I mean, I'm fully aware of how many women have had awful experiences working in the music industry. I feel really lucky though that nearly all my experiences have been positive, but there have been situations when I feel like I don't quite belong. And this can be kind of like a practical situation where the equipment doesn't quite fit, or for instance, on tour buses, that if you go to the loo, you can't put toilet paper down the toilet. A lot of times I've been working on all male tours, pretty much all men. And I'm really lucky because I feel very comfortable in that environment. I grew up with two older brothers, and I feel happy in the company of men, and that doesn't bother me at all. But I know that a lot of women have had situations that have been very difficult. I was just actually chatting with friends about this the other day, and everyone's got all kinds of stories to tell. But on the whole, I'm really lucky. I've just worked with lots of amazing men. What I would change though is there is a general attitude, even if people don't realise it, there can be quite subtle things happen that make you feel like you shouldn't really be there, and you know, it's not the place for you. And that can be comments, or it can be the fact that I've been in recording studios for over 20 years, and I've actually never had a female studio engineer. So studios for me are a very male setting, and that makes me feel like, you know, the music technology side of things, perhaps, you know, it's not for me because I've never seen a woman in that job. I know there are women in those jobs, and I know a lot more in London than in the North. I'd really like to see that change. And yeah, that was a bit of a barrier for me when I wanted to set up my own studio at home. I I felt really not very confident about it, basically. But then I ended up going on a course that was only for women to learn how to use music software. And that was absolutely brilliant. And I felt like I got a lot out of that. But it did make me much more comfortable being in an environment without men to learn how to use that equipment. And actually what I learned was that it's not often not as hard as it looks. And I think just because I'm not used to seeing someone like me doing it, I just think there's some kind of, you know, magic that I won't be able to achieve. But it wasn't like that at all. You know, you can learn everything. It just takes a bit of confidence, I guess, and a bit of support. Another thing that I'd really like to see changed, again, this is quite a subtle one, is how women are perceived as musicians on stage. I mean, I've had experiences in the past, and they're not, you know, they're not terrible. Again, I've heard much worse than this, you know, they're not terrible in any way. But for instance, when, you know, the end of a gig comes round and the band will get introduced and, you know, like so-and-so's on guitar, and it's usually like, you know, the talented so-and-so on guitar or the incredible blah, blah, blah on drums. And then so many times it's come round to, you know, me on the cello, and often it's the beautiful Liz on the cello. And it's, you know, it's not particularly upsetting, but I'd much rather be addressed as a musician and not have my appearance commented on, I guess. Often it can be seen as, let's look at, you know, they look nice in the corner. This is a bit of an issue for me, and it's something I've thought about for many years, because I sometimes feel like, you know, maybe 10 years ago, I'd probably dress up a lot more than I do now for a gig. And the reason I don't dress up so much now is because I really don't want to have that appearance of being like a glamorous assistant, for instance. And I really hate that. And I really don't want to appear like that. And it's awful that is a thing. But I just feel like if I really dressed up, that is what I'd feel like rather than a musician. So I only wear flat shoes, for instance, on stage now. I never wear heels. I make myself look nice, but I'm not going to go over the top because I want to be there as a musician rather than someone who's looking incredibly glamorous in the corner. You know, for me, if women do want to dress up, that's totally their choice, and that's wonderful as well. And, you know, it's your decision. But for me, that's how I cope with that side of things. So I guess the way for this to change, perhaps, is just having more women working in the industry. I think that's definitely going to be the way for things to shift. I feel very proud that I run the Up North Session Orchestra with my colleague Natalie Purton. So we fix sessions in the north of England, and historically a lot of sessions have happened in London, and we sort of saw this gap and realised we have so many incredible musicians in the north, and decided to set up the company, and that's going really well. But again, it's for us, it's a very male-dominated world. You know, all the studios we work in are male, and a lot of the composers we work with are male. There are female artists that we work with, but majority, I would say, are male still. So I do hope we see a change in this in the future.
Wow. Well, the world does definitely need to change. And one of the ways is that we get this kind of idea of inclusive design. So if we're kind of designing any project, there's anything we're doing, we're getting the voices of the people who are impacted round the table at that early stage, not retrofitting it later on. And that might make that change. There's so many artists that you have worked with that I can't wait to delve into today. I think it's worth mentioning now that as we record this, you're going to be soon doing some rehearsals and going out on tour with Pulp. Tell us about how that's come around. And is it right that the rehearsals are quite late, last minute before the actual thing?
Yeah, so that's come around through a friend, Richard Hawley, who put me in touch. And we'll be rehearsing. And then I'm doing about 6 dates in the north of England, which I'm very excited about. I do love Pulp. So, yeah, it's really exciting.
And like, do you know what the songs are yet? You don't have to say what they are, but like, do you know that yet? And do you know your parts yet? Like, when will the kind of finalized piece of music be kind of worked out? Is it on the day
so
before?
So usually we'll be sent parts. So as string players, usually, you know, you may be sent parts before the rehearsal, but often there is usually just maybe even one rehearsal, maybe two. And yeah, it can be quite kind of, not with a pop tour, but it can be quite sort of last minute in some cases, you know. And in some cases I, you know, I may be rehearsing just before the gig. You know, that has definitely happened in the past. And this can be like quite a wonderful thing though. And I think this has kind of created some of my most favourite moments of my career, because sometimes when you're having that rehearsal just before a gig, you're just sat in a, you know, in a dressing room running it through with an artist, and you get to hear their voice acoustically with no microphone. And it's the most amazing thing ever. You know, some of the people I've heard just, you know, sat next to me. It's such a pleasure. And, you know, it makes me just feel like I'm the luckiest person in the world, really. So.
And are you someone, so will you have the sheet music written in front of you while you're playing? Is it something that you try and, do off the cuff? How will that work with you, given there's such little rehearsal time?
So it completely depends on the project. So a lot of things I do will literally just have sheet music, and I will arrive and, you know, read it through. And then you have the sheet music for the gig as well. And that's, you know, that's happening for a few things I've got coming up. For instance, the James tour, it's like an orchestral version. So we all have sheet music and, you know, rehearsals, and the same with Pulp. It's all written down and we go and play. But I still, I do a lot of playing without sheet music as well. I've kind of steered my career to do more improvisation, which I really love exploring. And it's, I think it's kind of been good for me as a musician as well. So there are a lot of projects I do where it's completely either made up on the spot, because I do improvising to silent films, or if I'm playing with a band, it may be something I've made up originally and then I just don't have sheet music because it's already there, if that makes sense. But it does completely depend on the project. So for instance, with Liam, a lot of the songs we just kind of arranged with Mike, the guitarist. So we just kind of arranged the songs, and usually I, you know, hadn't written them down. Sometimes I had, but I'd always have them in memory for that. I wouldn't have sheet music because it just wouldn't look right. So yeah, they were always in my head for that.
So as someone who's so well respected at what you do, when was the last time that you felt a bit out of your depth, right? So was that years ago? Was it recently? When was the last time you were like a bit, not imposter syndrome, but like, you know, this is a bit of a stretch, this is a challenge. Like, when, how long, how often does that happen when you get
that,
to your level?
That happens quite often. I could probably just say yes yesterday.
Is it? Really? Wow.
Yeah, it's something I'm always kind of not battling with, but kind of exploring and kind of talking myself around. I think having imposter syndrome, which I definitely have some of, you know, for sure, I think it's not a bad thing, because I think it makes you want to be better and it makes you want to improve. And interestingly, like a little while ago, I do a lot of sessions, so recording in recording studios, and actually I run a session orchestra, so we also fix players for sessions, and they can be anything from, like, you know, an album to TV or film, and we do all kinds of different types of music. And because I don't play that much classical music anymore, you know, I don't really do orchestral playing. There was one session where it was definitely classical, and there were not many of us, and it was a definitely classical vibe. And yeah, I felt slightly like I had some imposter syndrome, but I actually really enjoyed it as well. Do you know what I mean? I felt like, oh, you know, it almost felt like quite fun to be playing something that I don't do that often. But yeah,
And what's your go-to approach, like, in that situation? So we have a lot of young musicians listening to this. If you are in that moment where you're a bit rabbit in the headlights, and this must have happened perhaps early in your career, where, I don't know, you have that doubt, what's your go-to way to focus? You know, what do you do to focus your way kind of out of that? Or is it a case that you just let it, you kind of roll with the punches?
So quite a long time ago, like very early on in my career, I was almost going to stop, actually. I felt like, oh, maybe I can't do this, you know, this isn't for me. And I was almost thinking about doing something completely different. But I had a bit of a moment and I just thought, actually, think about what you can do well. You know, what is your thing? And that is my biggest advice to anyone. And I decided, actually, the thing that I feel that I can do well, and I feel like I'm totally blowing my own trumpet, but you've got to do that, haven't you? Is I feel like I can play with emotion. And I feel like I know that I'm never going to be Yo-Yo Ma or like Ostrapovich sort of level. I just don't have the hours in the day. I'm not physically built to be like that. There's all kinds of reasons why I'm not going to be, you know, a big soloist somewhere. And I just thought, well, actually, I can do that thing. So I'm going to focus on that and see where that takes me. And just if I get to something that I just feel like, oh, this is really hard, or I'm not sure what I'm doing here, then I just kind of pour my heart out into it and hope for the best. And usually that works. You know, if you go with the mood of the music and the emotion, usually that sort of solves everything, really.
That's really interesting, because there's an interesting, I've got a load of books behind me here, and one of them is by a guy called Tom Rath, who writes, it's a book called Strengths Finder 2.0, which I recommend our listeners to have a dip into. And basically his idea is that we spend as humans too much time identifying the things we're not so good at and trying to make incremental improvements to them, whereas actually what we should do is kind of just manage those and then identify the things we're good at and then amplify the opportunities to do them, and that will have way more impact than ever just kind of trying to incrementally improve the things we're not so good at or not so confident in. And that's kind of what you've done. So you've kind of found your niche and gone, okay, I'm good at this and I'm going to amplify that. That's amazing. And going back to, so you, did you grow up in Sheffield, is that right?
I just wanted to say one more thing, actually, if you don't mind, Chris. You know, there's the whole thing about kind of being good at, you know, finding your strengths and something you're good at and going with that. But there's also, for me, finding things that you know that you'd like to do, but you can't do yet. So, for instance, with improvising, it's near the end of leaving university, it was the first time I got in a band, and a friend of mine invited me along to go and play in a band, and it was with a friend called Justin Lewis, and it was called the Justin Lewis Orchestra. And I remember very clearly the first rehearsal where I turned up, and at this point in my life I'd only played classical music, I hadn't played any other type of music at all. I turned up and they just said, okay, here's the first song, play. And I just had no idea what to do. I just sat there going, I don't know what to play. And my friend kind of nudged me and told me to play like a G and then a D or something. And it was literally that bad. And I'd have to write down all the chords and think about what might fit. And that was the beginning of my improvisation career. So from there, I played in bands a lot. I went to a lot of jam nights. Had no idea what I was doing, really. And just kind of thought I'd have a go. And I really enjoyed it, and you know, often I get it wrong, and that's fine. You know, it's you've got to learn somehow, haven't you? And then from there, I ended up doing quite a lot of sort of things in like art exhibitions and all kinds of like little improvisation things with theatre and all kinds of stuff. And it's actually led up now to the point where, you know, I do that for part of my career. So I play in a silent film improvisation group. So we play to silent films, and it's wonderful because it's like, for me, it's the most like playing, as in the word to play, that you could possibly get as a musician. And, you know, I'm fully aware that I'm not the world's most technical improviser, you know, and I know there's people that are amazing, that they can play over any kind of incredible jazz chords and they could do anything. And, you know, I know I can't do that. I don't have perfect pitch. There's a lot of things I know I can't do, but then I just go with the things I can do. And and I love doing that. And for me, that's like one of the biggest journeys of my career. And that's also led to doing my album, which is, a lot of it is improvised. And I feel like when I improvise like that, it's like the most me music coming out, if that makes sense. The music that is the most me.
That's so interesting. It's almost a bit spooky because one of the questions I was going to ask about was the transition as a classical artist to improvising. Because I went to almost an identical story, but I went to music university, and I remember we were asked to perform solo in the first kind of week or so. And then week two, first lesson came back. And so I should say there was this person who was a classical pianist, grade eight pianist, virtuoso. And then week two, they said, right, we're going to put you into bands and you have to perform a song in 1 hour. It's like, Benny King, Stand By Me. So it's like, okay, fine, G minor C D, let's do it in G. This is really straightforward. And this person who is so much more of a sophisticated musician than every single person in the building, rabbit in the headlights, terrified, and they walked out because they didn't know what they were gonna do in that situation, right? And so it's, which I couldn't get my head around. It's like, how can you not just play G minor C D, given that's so much easier in my world than because I wasn't sight reading. So well done for making that leap. And I can almost physically see as I observe you, like the weight of your shoulders, you know, so that you can now do, so you've got so much choice in situations,
yeah,
right?
It's
so
true, yeah.
You know, if anything goes wrong, you can improvise. If something goes wrong, you can always improvise.
I really
your way
had
out
to do that. And actually I think that's one of my my superpowers now, is like, something goes wrong, how can I make it sound right? And I feel like I can totally achieve that. I've had some brilliant moments where things have gone wrong and I've just made it sound better. You know, the best bit of advice is, play a wrong note, play it again with conviction, and then everyone just thinks it's a right note.
So when it came to your solo stuff, what do you think, what side of your personality comes out more when you're creating music that perhaps doesn't come out so much when you're just living your day-to-day life?
That's a very interesting question. I think generally, like, I'm a lot better than I used to be. I've been quite a kind of, not stressy, but kind of, I'm quite, what's the word? I'm a very busy person, and I'm very kind of like always on the go and always doing stuff, and you know, I never really stop, and I'm, you know, it can be quite hard work for my husband. And I'm, you know, I really love my job, so I love doing what I do, and I'm always sort of, I feel almost quite flighty, and you know, I mean, I'm a lot more relaxed than I used to be, so it's definitely changed. But I think when I play my music, it creates a relaxedness in me that I don't think I have in everyday life. I think actually playing the cello now actually relaxes me.
So your new album, I believe it came about by you being in Sheffield and kind of visualising what Sheffield might have looked like a long, long time ago, and kind of building it from there. So it's quite a conceptual album, I believe. Tell us about how it came about and how you're feeling about it on the cusp of its release.
So with the album, you know, for many years I just played with other people, you know, I never even thought about doing my own project. And then just a few elements came together at once, really. So in about, I mean, the date's roughly about 2020, I started playing with a friend and neighbour, Michael Walsh, who's an Irish flute player. And I'd always loved folk music, you know, I really love folk music, and it's kind of been with me all my life, really. I used to go to Cropredy Festival in Oxfordshire, and I played with Michael, and I really enjoyed it. And he did an album as well called Quairhawk, and I played on his album, and that was great. And Mike was just incredibly encouraging. And he just said, you know, you can play folk music too. And I just always thought, actually, cello isn't a folk instrument. So I didn't think that was a thing. And I don't know why I didn't realise this, but cello can play folk music. So, I kind of started exploring this idea that maybe I could play folk music. But I also didn't want to be like a trad folk musician, because I'm not one. You know, I haven't grown up with the tradition. But I thought I could kind of make my own style. And so at this point, it was, so I also set up a home studio just before the pandemic. Like, it's almost like I had a premonition, like I might need a home studio. I know.
Good timing.
And so I then, you know, for the first time in my life, I had the opportunity to just sit down and record things myself. And I don't think I'd ever have, like, hired a studio to go and record things in. Just hadn't crossed my mind. So I just kind of started exploring. and this kind of folk style that I really loved, I kind of mixed with all the other styles that I really loved, and just saw what happened, really. And as you mentioned, I used the inspiration kind of happened alongside it. It wasn't like I was inspired by my surroundings and then made this album. It was like it all kind of happened gradually. I live in an area called Mearsbrook in Sheffield, and actually I'm just looking out my window now, I'm on the edge of a valley. So because the lie of the land, you can still see the shape of the valley. There's houses all the way up and down now. But you can just see where the valley used to be. And I just wanted to kind of explore this thought of kind of stepping back in time and kind of creating the sounds. And so they it uses field recordings, so you've got sounds of woods and birds, and but not just that, you know, some of it is sounds of sort of traffic noise and all kinds of stuff.
Nice. Now, I said there was a story from Finsbury Park I wanted to share with you, which is quite nice, which was, we'd had Dan McDougall and Christian Madden on the podcast, and when Liam was playing Finsbury Park, very luckily, Christian managed to sort us out guest list. And a cool thing for any Liam Gallagher fan out there, if you really want to know what Liam's like, to collect tickets from a guest list, you have to pay £20 to a charity. So if you want to collect tickets for a guest list, you have to donate £20 to charity, which is just a great thing, isn't it? And we were backstage, and I was having a chat with Christian and Dan, and my partner, Davila, was there. And this person walked over and had a AAA pass and was chatting away at us, and it was like, oh, me and Davila, my partner, was like, oh, that's such a nice lady, and like said goodbye, you know. And I just thought, oh, maybe this person, I don't know, sound engineer, you know, she's definitely not part of the band because I've not seen her before, et cetera, et cetera. And I'd said to my partner that it's quite likely Liam was going to play a song called Whatever. And I said, I probably will get a bit of a lump in my throat when he plays that, because he hasn't played it for a long time. And I never thought I'd hear that song sung by him again in that way. And she was like, okay, that's fine. And it was the first time it's likely she was going to see me a bit choked up. So we're at the gig, and the first chords, you know, start, I think Jay was playing them. Chords come in, I get a lump in my throat, my partner turns to me, gives me a cuddle and a kiss. And then we look up, and that lovely person we were talking to was on the big screen, and it was Liz Hanks playing the cello, the famous orchestral part for Whatever, which was just a beautiful, beautiful moment. Like, oh, that's that really lovely person we spoke to. And here we are on the podcast like 3 or 4 years later. Tell us about how it came about that you ended up playing with Liam Gallagher, because you did those shows, and also you did the last minute Brit Awards performance as well, which was, I believe that was flying by the seats of the pants a little bit as well.
Fun. Yeah, so... So what happened was, it was through a friend of mine, Si Mei Wu, who also played in the earlies with Christian years back.
Oh,
and
right, yeah.
I did a little stint in the earlies too when Si Mei was away. So I knew Christian from that as well. So basically she'd done a couple of shows with them, and then she couldn't do the tour. So she just asked me to do it. She said, you know, go for it. I was really lucky, and I had such an amazing time doing it. It was incredible.
And tell us about rehearsals with Liam. So is he kind of asking you to, I mean, you mentioned Mike earlier. So, you know, were you getting feedback on Liam from Liam saying, can you play the part in this particular way? Or was it you just trusted to do that and he was doing his own thing?
Well, it just depended on what the situation was. I mean, with Whatever, actually, this is quite a good story. So I think Mike messaged me the day before saying, look, we want to do Whatever. And I had a really busy day, you know, when, like, you just got one of those crazy days, and I had to get on the train down to London the next morning for the rehearsals. But I remember about 10 o'clock at night thinking, I've got to work out this part for Whatever. And I knew that on the train, I could do some of it on the train, but I actually needed my cello to kind of figure out what worked and what didn't. And so I remember staying up quite late, like sorting it out and having it ready. And then I went down the train and I literally walked into the rehearsal room. They're like, right, we've got to do Whatever now, because it needs to be sent to Liam. I was like, okay. And I hadn't played the electric cello for a long time. And I just sat down, played it through. They recorded it immediately and sent it straight to Liam to check that he liked it. And I remember Mike saying, oh, thanks so much for like sorting it out. Because if I'd have just turned up and not done anything, it would have, you know, just ruined the rehearsal schedule, and there are lots to do. So that is a bit of a tip, actually, you know, be prepared, always be prepared, because it's always going to do you a favour, you know. And it's just so much better to be ready for anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, pretty much what I played then became the thing that I played live.
Did you play any other songs on that tour?
Yeah, so the songs that I mainly did were Wonderwall, which was fantastic, and that we did like an acoustic version. And then I did Live Forever as well. There was a few off the new album as well that I did, but we would only do them occasionally. So on that tour, and I remember once doing, you know, because you kind of, the beginning of a tour, it can be quite a long stretch. I remember once having just going along to another gig, I think it was Birmingham, and I think a song was sort of said, a song was announced, and I was like, oh my goodness, we haven't done that. I don't think we've ever played that. And so I was kind of trying to learn that, you know, in the next hour, because I always wanted to do everything from memory. So I remember kind of spending the next hour trying to learn this song.
So what, you got a message just saying this is going to be the set list tonight, this is what we're playing,
It can, it can be, you know, we just have to wait and see. And I remember a lovely moment, well, it wasn't lovely for me, but I remember another gig where just, you know, a couple of hours before, one of the song was, the key was changed. And like, for anyone playing guitar, that's easy, you just, you know, move the capo. But for me, and it was one with a lot of notes, I was like, oh my goodness. So the whole thing had to go up a semitone or something. But it was fine. I just had to just crack on and learn it. So sometimes, you know, there's, on tours like that, there can be periods you just sat around. You know, there's a lot of sitting around, a lot of waiting. But then sometimes it's like intense, like, right, got to sort this out. But I really like, I like that.
So what do you do in that what do you do in that moment? So I think that's a really important thing for young musicians. I think that is a terrifying situation. We had Gail Ann Dorsey, who is David Bowie's bassist, had the same situation. She said, despite how experienced she was, she said, if someone said, oh, we're going up a semitone and, you know, it's last minute and it's a song she doesn't know too well, it's just, even today, she would get this kind of like tsunami of like anxiety that come on board. In that hour, how are you going? I mean, how do you unlearn? And that's the thing, because you've got to unlearn the part and then kind of relearn it playing it a different way. And you can't tune up your strings by a semitone, right? It doesn't work like that.
No, unfortunately not. You just crack on. You've just got to like do the work. And actually, I mean, I remember once doing something where the gig had started and I knew I had two more listens through to the track that I was learning. So, yeah, sometimes you just got to like get on with it.
And what are your memories of to the Britwater? We had, when we did the Dan McDougall episode in Barcelona, and he was saying that, I think it was like the night before, Liam messaged him saying, look, can you, do you mind singing the falsetto bit on Live Forever? You know, you and I can live forever. And he was like, okay, great, in front of, you know, probably the largest TV viewers of the year, whatever it would be. What are your memories of actually rehearsing that? And is it something you've done already? Or did you have to, was that the first time you played
it? Oh, no, we'd played the track already. So that was fine.
Okay, so.
I had quite an amazing transition, actually, from, I was actually on holiday when I got the call in like a log cabin in the middle of nowhere with no electricity. And so I was, you know, off grid, and I got this call saying, you know, can you come and do this thing in London? Didn't even know what it was. And I managed to sort it out. I said, yeah, sure, you know, I'll get on a train tomorrow morning. So I had this kind of few trains to get home and grab a few things and then get down there. And then arrived, I think for some reason in my head, I hadn't quite thought about what we were doing. And I think for some reason I thought we were doing some kind of after show party, and I don't know why I thought this. And then I realized that no, we were actually playing at the Brit Awards. And so I arrived and found a cello had been hired for me, because I always used an electric cello for these, but I think it was from a different firm that had normally been used. And for the rehearsal, I looked in the case and there was no bow. And it was no one's fault from, you know, from the tour side of things. It was just that I think the company just hadn't put it in. And so I didn't have a bow for the rehearsal. So when we got to the main thing, I did eventually get a bow. Apart from that year was the one year when there was not another single string player at the Brit Awards. You know, normally you've got some kind of string player somewhere doing something, but no, not this year. So we just had to wait until they delivered a bow. So when we actually played, it was kind of the first time I'd heard the playing that day. When we did it live on stage, it was kind of like, oh yeah, here we go, I can hear myself, it's okay. So that was exciting.
They're very special songs and they mean a lot to a lot of people. So thank you for bringing them to life in the way that you did. You mentioned before we were recording about your relationship with Richard Hawley and that you knew him from a very early stage and he was in his kitchen.
It wasn't his kitchen. So I knew Richard from, like, this is going back to the first band I played in that I mentioned, called the Justin Lewis Orchestra. So we had the same manager as Richard, Graham Wrench. But before Richard even had that manager, I just kind of knew him around Sheffield. And yeah, I remember being at a mutual friend's house. It's actually Shez, his guitarist's house. I mean, it must have been quite late at night. And I remember Richard just saying to me, I've got these songs that I'm thinking of doing a solo thing. And he just played me some of his songs and they were absolutely beautiful. And then I think he went into the studio. So at a studio called Yellow Arch in Sheffield. And he was recording some songs for his first, I think it was an EP. I can't remember whether the first, was it an album or an EP? And he got me and my friend, Liz Lipscomb, on violin to go and play on these tracks. And it's kind of carried on from there. So I'm really lucky. I've played on every Richard Hawley album now, apart from one. There's one I wasn't on because there weren't any strings on it. So I feel so lucky, and I love Richard's music so much, and really it's kind of like become a soundtrack to my time in Sheffield. You know, it's kind of like spanned my time here, and yeah, amazing.
He's one of the most important British artists in the last 15 years for me, and he's that's so incredible you get to work with him in such close proximity. I mean, what's he like to work with? You know, I'm interested in how artists at that level kind of give feedback to people they're working with. You know, if you're not playing the part exactly as he wants, you know, how does that come across? Is he very kind about it? Is he frustrated? Is he someone who knows how to give feedback effectively that's going to help you in that situation?
I mean, yeah, he's lovely and he's always good at giving feedback, and he knows exactly what he wants, and I think that's really important.
That helps.
You know, he knows when something isn't right and he'll tell you, and that's fine. No, it's great. And I just love what he does. It's fantastic. And he's, an amazing musician, an amazing man.
Tell us about playing with Smokey Robinson. I mean, wow. I mean, it's a long time ago, I believe, but wow, playing with Smokey Robinson, that's a big deal. How did that come about, and what did you do?
So that was, this was a very long time ago. This was very early on, and I was really lucky. It was through a fixer from Birmingham, who was putting together a string section. And I think they'd basically been touring with the world, and each place they went to, they just had another section. You know, they just have the strings in from wherever they were. And it was just quite amazing, really. So I remember starting the tour at the Albert Hall, and then we did sort of all the sort of big venues throughout the UK. But it was wonderful, like the rest of the band, I think a lot of them had been with Smokey Robinson for many years, and some of them, you know, proper sort of Motown musicians, and it was amazing. Wow. Yeah, it's really amazing.
What did you learn from working with Smokey Robinson that you might not have learned from working with anyone else?
Ooh, I think it was probably, for me, it was like the beginning of doing kind of bigger shows. There's probably the biggest shows that I'd done in kind of, you know, that kind of genre. And just really just learning how things work and what you do and what you don't do. That's a really big part for me of, like, of, you know, of being asked back to do things. And it's, you've got to sort of be the right fit. So you have to be able to say the right things at the right time. I don't mean, like, you know, you have to kind of like hide in the corner or anything, but you just got to know when you shouldn't say anything. And you got to know when, you know, it's good to go and ask something. And does that make sense? It's just kind of like
It totally does. I mean, this delves into an area that I think is really important for the, like, young musicians listening to this, is kind of what are the skills that you think are underrated that every musician should have? And, you know, I'll be interested in your answering that. But when you just said what not to do and when not to do it, how would you analyze that? Is that trusting your intuition? Is it knowing where your place is in some ways? So how have you, what have you learned in that process, and when is the right time and when is not the right time?
I mean, maybe I'm talking about kind of rehearsal situations where there's lots of discussion going on. Sometimes we don't need another voice, do you know what I mean? It's just best to sit there and let it happen. Unless it's something that really affects you, just leave it. There's enough people discussing. So it's always good just to be really aware that you can just sit back and watch things and, you know, and listen rather than have to get involved. I think for me, the biggest, it might sound a bit silly, but the biggest thing about sort of working in the music industry and people wanting to ask you back again is just actually being nice. You know, just be nice. And it does wonders, you know. If you can fit in well with people, sometimes you've got to just be aware of situations and kind of go with how, you know, the vibe in the room. And do you know what I mean? You've got to just be a nice person and friendly, and also don't be the one that's moaning, and, you know, don't be the one that's saying I'm tired all the time, because everyone's tired. There's no point in saying that. Just kind of be the smile in the morning, be the person that says good morning to everyone. And
it's a really good answer. It's actually Dan McDougall said pretty much the same thing, people skills, having those people skills. Yeah. So just like, it is an underrated thing. I think that it's important that people hear that. Yeah. I mean, this is a delicate topic, but how do you go about discussing splits or discussing whether it's day rates or contributions to song so that you are, and everyone feels that you're fairly remunerated for your contribution? Because I think a lot of musicians are at risk of being exploited out of fear. In fact, I know of people who even last night I heard someone basically talking about the same thing, because they don't know when to say, okay, how is this being split, and you know, what my day rate might be, etc. And they get exploited in that situation. And I think if you are a young musician, you're at risk of that. So what would be your advice to a young musician to making sure that they don't get exploited in a situation like that?
Well, for me, in terms of like splits and things, I don't have to deal with that very often, because generally if I'm playing on other people's music, it's as a session musician. There has been cases like in the last few years where I've definitely contributed more than just being a session musician, and that, and those times, that's when discussions can come in.
Who instigates those discussions in a situation like that?
It's usually me. I'm a lot better.
Right. Okay. So the artist isn't kind of forthcoming with that, right? So you do need to
some
take that leap.
Some people might be. So it just depends. But I'm a lot better at this than I used to be. And actually, I find it quite odd when people now might get in touch to, you know, say, can you come and do this session or this gig? And they don't just discuss money straight away. Just think, well, just discuss it. It's not a problem. You know, I don't bite, and might as well just talk about it, because I think a lot of people can feel a bit embarrassed about it still. I don't quite understand why.
Yep.
But for me, it's pretty easy, because with sessions, I generally use all the MU session rates. So it's all set. And that's so nice, just have a list and you just say, right, this is what it is. And sometimes it might be a bit more, depending on where it is and what we're doing or the level that it's at. So that's nice and easy. And then when it comes to live shows, it just depends on each project. And they just tell us what the rate is. And, you know, if I don't like it, then I won't do it. But it doesn't seem too hard for me at the moment. But that
great. So that's really good that you got to the point in your career where you can be forthright and instigate that conversation around if it feels slightly beyond session. What is the first sentence you are saying in that situation? How would you advise someone to lead that? Because it feels like to you maybe not, but I think to a lot of people, that feels like a very nervous and embarrassing conversation to have. What is the sentence you're asking when you're kind of instigating that conversation where you feel, hang on, I feel I should be getting more contribution. I've contributed more to this than just a session, right?
well, this would always be discussed beforehand, I guess, as well. So it would be something, if I knew that I was adding something that was, you know, totally, the whole track is about the cello, then it would have to be discussed beforehand. And actually, probably most of the time, I would just charge a sort of higher session rate. But now, actually, interestingly, one of the reasons that I made my album was because of this, because so many times in the past, I'd kind of done something and you know, my name's kind of left off in some ways because I'm not actually an artist, I'm a session musician. So I kind of felt like, yeah, I didn't like that anymore. I just felt like, you know, I need to kind of make my own name now. Not to like take over the world or anything, just to, you know, just to give myself a place. And yeah, that's part of my reason, was to kind of further my career in that way, that I felt like, you know, I had my own thing.
It can be hard for session musicians to, you know, you've almost got to be at peace with being slightly overlooked, and this is why this podcast exists. It's literally to put shine a light on people who perhaps deserve a bit more credit than they sometimes get. Have you ever found yourself frustrated in the past at not being more recognised, given the quality of your contributions?
Not really. There's one instance. I don't know if I should say.
You don't have to name names, but
no, there's definitely something I played on where I was definitely like the melody line, and you know, pretty much the whole track actually. And I should have definitely had, you know, more than I was offered. And I think I didn't realise when I was offered it that it would be so much, so cello heavy. But, you know, you live and learn, don't you? And I just let that go because there's no point. I'd signed a contract already, just let it go and learn the lesson for the next time. But no, I'm definitely better at kind of knowing my place and knowing, you know, what I can ask for. And but places like the MU can really help with, you know, putting a price on things. And yeah, it's good.
That's really good advice. Now, one of the projects you've been involved in recently, or not too long ago, is probably one of my favourite things you've been involved in, which is with Self-Esteem. You re-recorded some of the songs from Prioritise Pleasure in this kind of orchestral way. And as I said to you on a voice note yesterday, I actually think a couple of those are better than the original versions. That's how good they are, particularly Prioritise Pleasure. Yeah, wow.
Amazing.
The vocal that's, you know, that Self-Esteem's done on that is incredible. Tell us about how that came about and what your kind of fondest memories are of the recording process.
So that came about through Colin Elliott, who is also the producer for Richard Hawley. And he did the string arrangements for Self-Esteem. He's done all the string arrangements for Richard Hawley as well. And so Colin works at Yellow Arch Studios. Well, he owns Yellow Arch Studios. And so Self-Esteem, Rebecca used to be in a band called Slow Club, and I played with them on their tracks, you know, quite a few years ago. So I'd already done something with her, but that was a long time ago. And Colin just got in touch saying, you know, we'd like strings for these tracks coming up. So
yeah, it turned out beautifully. What's if I gave you the power to attend one gig that you played but see it from the audience's perspective, which gig would it be?
Goodness.
In your whole career?
That's a really hard question. There was such a lovely gig just before Christmas. I was playing in the Richard Hawley's musical, Standing at the Sky's Edge, which was on at the Crucible. So I was like a dep for a week of that, and it was such a pleasure. And actually during that week, I got a message saying, could I come and play at the Richard Hawley show at the Lead Mill? It was a lovely week. So I went and played an absolutely gorgeous Hawley show, and it was so lovely. Just a really special night, and I think, you know, I've known all the band for many years now, and it just felt really lovely. I think that's it, it's all about people, isn't it, as well. I'd like to go and watch that one.
Nice. We'll begin to wrap up in a moment. If you were president of the music industry for one day, what would you change?
I mean, I think you know, after all the Brexit malarkey, I think bringing in free movement for musicians would be good. You know, I'm about to go, I've got one gig in Rotterdam in a few weeks, and that's brought all kinds of headaches just getting there. So I'd love that to come into place. What else? Oh, I know. So musicians being fairly paid for streaming would be really good. You know, it's got to the point of ridiculous. So definitely needs to change. You know, it can't really go on like this now.
What's further advice you'd give to young musicians?
I think one of the most important things I would say, especially at the beginning, is never sit around waiting for the phone to ring. I remember when I first left university, this is kind of hilarious now, I actually sent letters, like written letters, to all the recording studios in Sheffield saying, hi, I'm a cellist based in Sheffield, you know, do you want a cellist for a session? Ring me. I actually sent that by post. And do you know, that actually led to my first professional session. So when I went and played, wow, with the Long Pigs, and that was from my letter, which is kind of hilarious now. So yeah, I think throughout my career, if I've ever had little dips where there's not much going on, I usually just think, right, what can I do next? You know, what can I make happen? For instance, you know, when I set up my studio just before the pandemic, that wasn't really, you know, wasn't meant to be a massive thing. I just thought it's time. I went on a course that it was just for women to learn how to use music technology, which was amazing. They're called Equalize.
Nice.
And, you know, I was pretty useless to begin with. I remember they asked me to put a memory stick into my computer to download something. I actually had no idea what to do. And they were lovely. And they just said, look, wow, you need to learn. Don't worry about it. We'll show you. So I've learned very quickly how to use technology and how to use my studio. But the studio, because I didn't sit around during the pandemic, I had to earn some money. I made sure that I made the studio work, and it, you know, that was basically my living throughout the pandemic. I did lots of recording for various album projects and for film and TV. And it's been brilliant. But yeah, as I said, never sit around, you know, make something else happen if it's not working out.
And you've done a lot of interesting stuff with some major networks, which I can't name, in regards to writing music for film, or kind of composing music for film, or playing for music for film. That's always an interesting process, because when you're playing to a piece of film that is silent, which you obviously know a lot about, you can change the interpretation of that scene very, very easily from your playing. So Quentin Tarantino famously said the reason why he would use archive music rather than someone compose music for his films is he didn't want someone to have more power over his film than himself as a director. Oh, wow. And writer. Which is kind of an interesting concept. So when you're playing stuff for these major networks, are you sending stuff off and they say, no, we want something quite different to that? Or is it, it's given to you on a plate and you just play
it? It's all very much given to me on a plate and I play it. But, you know, nice. You can still add your own touch. And I think everyone's just got their own sound, haven't they? So it's still a bit of yourself. But no, it's definitely all written. I've been doing some library music as well. So basically, you know, you record music and it gets sent off and put into a library, which then can be used for tracks, you know, which then can be used, you know, say for TV and film. But they'll be bought from the library, if that makes sense. And in some of those cases, I've been improvising for the people that I'm recording for, but that then are paid in a different way. And actually, I'm doing some library music coming up that I'm going to be kind of sharing the split for, because we're doing it as a collaboration project. So it's generally for these things, it's always written down. But yeah, occasionally there is some element of my own music going in as well.
time to give, and I'm feeling it so much more.
I'm fully aware that I'm constantly learning. And when it came to the recording studio, I was asking everyone about kind of, you know, mic placements and things like that. And I realised that everyone has a different idea about how you place your mics. So I got all this advice and I tried this new mic placement out, and it was for a very high profile artist. Well, I'm not going to mention. Actually, they never used the recording that I did because the track never got released. So that's okay. But I remember finishing it off and sending it and thinking, oh, brilliant, it's all done. And my husband, Jack, walked in. He said, Liz, do you know that mic's facing in the wrong direction? And like, I basically had it facing the wall. And anyway, then I got almost a minute later, I got a message back saying, oh, it sounds great, thanks so much. I'm just like, great. So actually, you know, I wouldn't obviously be doing that now, but there's so much that, you know, you can worry about, but it's fine. You know, you just do your best. And I've realized about mic placement, it's just what works for you. And you just got to experiment, because you can get all the advice in the world and read all the articles and actually just go with what works for you.
So thank you for your insight and your wisdom. You've played some incredible concerts throughout your career. You continue to do so. You're doing so many different projects that it's almost hard to keep up with, as you've kind of cited yourself. And that's great that you're keeping so busy and that you're getting so much out of the industry, because you're putting so much into it as well. We look forward to seeing how you get on with the Pulp tour over the summer. That's a really, really high profile big thing. And good luck with the new album as well. Where can we hear your new album?
So it's available at Hudson Records. And on all sort of platforms, it's called Land.
For more episodes featuring comedian Stuart Lee, Tony Visconti, Gamarcha of Oasis, David Bowie bassist Gail Ann Dorsey, Queen's musical director Spike Edney, the police manager Miles Copeland III, Kate Nash, Ian Brody, Stormzy producer Fraser T. Smith, Katie Cole of the Smashing Pumpkins, Clive Deem of Radiohead, and Richard Fortus of Guns N' Roses, go to thestagelefpodcast.com and drop us a DM on Instagram, Facebook or Twitter to let us know what your biggest takeaway was from each interview. Search The Stage Left Pod and you'll find us.